would include the strongest language in support of improving the lives of Native Americans in the history of our country. To accomplish that goal, I appointed Deborah Parker, a Native American leader from the Tulalip tribes, to the Democratic Platform Committee. Deborah accomplished wonders on that committee, and thanks to her hard work, the platform addresses issues ranging from honoring and strengthening the trust relationship to dealing with economic development, housing, healthcare, education, women's rights, environmental protection, and much more. Now we must make sure the language in that platform is implemented. We owe the first Americans a debt of gratitude that can never be fully repaid. It's time we started trying. It's time for a new federal relationship with the Native American people. A better day. In his inaugural remarks in January 1937, in the midst of the Great Depression, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt looked out at the nation, and this is what he saw. He saw tens of millions of citizens denied the basic necessities of life. He saw millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hung over them day by day. He saw millions denied education, recreation, and the opportunity to better their lot and the lot of their children. He saw millions lacking the means to buy the products they needed, and by their poverty and lack of disposable income, denying opportunities for employment to many other millions. He saw one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished. And he acted. That is exactly what we as a nation need to do today. That and even more. This is not 1937. Despite the Wall Street crash of 2008, we are much better off economically in 2016 than we were during the Great Depression. But we must be honest and recognize that millions of Americans in every corner of this country are experiencing significant economic pain and suffering. We must end the incredible despair that drives too many of our youth to drugs, alcohol, and suicide, and confront the reality that far too many of them are now dying at a younger age than their parents did or will. We must end the disgrace of having the highest level of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth, and having public school systems in inner cities that are totally failing our children, where kids now stand a greater chance of ending up in jail than ending up with a college degree. We must no longer abide the reality of tens of thousands of Americans dying every year from preventable deaths because they either lack health insurance, have high deductibles, or cannot afford the outrageously high cost of prescription drugs they need. We must end the current situation in which hundreds of thousands of bright young people are unable to go to college because their families are poor or working class, while millions more struggle with suffocating levels of student debt. We must alleviate the pain of single mothers and families who cannot feed their children because they are working at starvation wages. We must never again poison entire cities with lead-tainted water because we have allowed our infrastructure to crumble and decay before our eyes. We must end the disgrace of tens of thousands of veterans sleeping out on the streets. We must make certain that the elderly and the disabled live with dignity and security. In other words, we must create a responsive government that works for all the people and not just a few at the top.
10. Corporate media and the threat to our democracy. As A.J. Liebling wrote, quote, "Freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one," end quote. Today, a handful of multinational corporations own much of the media and control what the American people see, hear, and read. This is a direct threat to American democracy. It is an issue we cannot continue to ignore. Media shapes our very lives. It tells us what products we need to buy, and by the quantity and nature of coverage, what is, quote, important and what is, quote, unimportant. Media shapes our political consciousness and informs us as to the scope of what is, quote, realistic and, quote, possible. When we see constant coverage of murders and brutality on television, corporate media is telling us that crime and violence are important issues that we should be concerned about. When there is round-the-clock coverage of the Super Bowl, we are being informed that football and the NFL deserve our rapt attention. When there is very little coverage of the suffering of the 43 million Americans living in poverty, or the thousands of Americans without health insurance who die each year because they can't get to a doctor when they should, corporately owned media is telling us that these are not issues of major concern. For years, major crises like climate change, the impact of trade agreements on our economy, the role of big money in politics, and youth unemployment have received scant media coverage. Trade union leaders, environmentalists, low-income activists, people prepared to challenge the corporate ideology rarely appear on our TV screens. Media is not just about what is covered and how it is covered. More importantly, it is about what is not covered. And those decisions of what is and is not covered are not made in the heavens. They are made by human beings who often have major conflicts of interest. Every serious presidential campaign spends a great deal of time developing media strategy, and we were no exception. While our campaign was largely focused on grassroots activities, we paid a great deal of attention to television, radio, newspapers, and magazines, and how, through them, we could best get our ideas out to the public. In my life as a mayor, congressman, and United States Senator from Vermont, I had a lot of involvement with local media. I would hold Vermont press conferences fairly frequently and speak to reporters via telephone many times a week. I also did something that I believe was unique in Congress. For many years, I conducted an hour-long national radio town hall meeting with an old friend, the progressive radio talk show host, Tom Hartman. Tom and I would chat for a half hour or so about the current issues, and I would then take questions from all across the country. It was a lot of fun, and I believe informative for the listeners. Running for president, however, exposed me to a whole different level of media coverage. Over the course of the campaign, I spoke to hundreds of national and local reporters, and very few days went by when I was not interacting with someone from the mainstream media. What I learned from that experience was that, as a general rule of thumb, the more important the issue is to large numbers of working people, the less interesting it is to corporate media. The less significant it is to ordinary people, the more attention the media plays. Further, issues being pushed by the top 1% get a lot of attention. Issues advocated by representatives of working families, not so much. This was, to be honest, not a new revelation to me. I had seen it for years as a congressman and senator. Before I relate some of my media experiences on the campaign trail, let me give you one example of the nature of media coverage that I will never forget, which took place in the U.S. Senate. In 2013, there was a lot of clamoring in Congress about the need to cut Social Security. Wall Street, corporate lobbyists, virtually all Republicans, and a few Democrats were arguing falsely that Social Security was going broke, was adding to the deficit, and that benefits would need to be scaled back. These attacks against Social Security had received an enormous amount of media coverage. They were becoming, quote, accepted wisdom, what everybody was supposed to believe. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and I worked together to fight back. We knew that these cuts would be a disaster for millions of seniors and disabled veterans trying to survive on $12,000 or $13,000 a year. We also knew that there were ways to protect and extend Social Security benefits without hurting some of the most vulnerable people in our country. As part of our strategy, we brought together organizations that represented tens of millions of Americans who were strongly opposed to these cuts. Our coalition included the AARP and virtually every senior group in the country, the American Legion, and every major veterans organization, the AFL-CIO, representing more than 13 million workers, the largest disability organizations in America, and the National Organization for Women. On January 31st, 2013, we held a press conference with the leadership of all of these organizations. I had never in my political life been part of an event where organizations had come together representing so many people from all walks of life, more than 50 million Americans in total. And together they were telling Congress, do not cut Social Security. Together they were speaking out on one of the most important issues facing ordinary Americans. Guess what? That event received almost no coverage. It was not of interest to the corporately owned media. And that was not unusual. Time and time again, issues of enormous consequence to working families get relatively little attention. Needless to say, running for president changed my media profile. As a result of the success of our campaign, I found myself getting far more attention from the national media. I was on Meet the Press, This Week with George Stephanopoulos, State of the Union, Face the Nation, and Fox News Sunday multiple times. In fact, there were more than a few mornings when I appeared on 3 or 4 of the Sunday shows on the same day. I also appeared on virtually every late-night show, often more than once. Stephen Colbert had me on his show frequently, and I appeared with Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, Larry Wilmore, and Seth Meyers, as well as returning to the Bill Maher Show. I even found myself doing a routine on Saturday Night Live with my impersonator, Larry David, who did Bernie Sanders better than I did. If you want to know about the impact of television, go on Saturday Night Live, or better yet, have a brilliant comic imitate you on the program. For a while, Larry was getting more attention than I was. When I was in New York, I appeared frequently on the ABC, CBS, and NBC morning shows. On PBS, I made several appearances with Tavis Smiley and Judy Woodruff. I even chatted on several occasions with Troy Behar, Whoopi Goldberg, and the other ladies of The View, and I showed the world how bad a dancer I am with Ellen DeGeneres on her show. My kids were impressed that I made the cover of Rolling Stone, as well as Time and a number of other magazines. When you run a serious campaign for president, you get a lot of attention, and I did. Before I announced for president, I doubt that 15% of the American people knew who I was. By the time the campaign ended, I was more or less nationally known. That was the good news for my campaign, and it tells you what a lot of hard work and a good communications director, Michael Briggs, can accomplish. Here was the bad news. In terms of my campaign's relationship to the national corporate media, we were at a distinct disadvantage for a number of reasons. First, when the campaign began, I was considered by the pundits to be a fringe candidate, not serious, not someone who had a chance to win. Mainstream media does not spend a lot of time covering candidates they believe cannot win, and that was certainly reflected both in the amount and the kind of coverage we received. In the New York Times, my opening announcement made page 19, and there wasn't much more coverage on the national networks. Second, corporate media owned by large multinational corporations are not all that sympathetic to ideas that attack the corporate establishment. In fact, in the very first set of speeches that I gave, I talked about the need for a political revolution which would take on the economic, political, and media establishment. That's probably not the best way to ingratiate yourself with those who cover you. Issues like the need to reform our failed trade policies, the need for a Medicare for All single-payer healthcare system, climate change, and the need for progressive tax reform, issues that I focused on during the campaign and which challenge the wealthy and powerful, are not the kinds of subjects that the corporate media gravitates towards. Third, the nature of media coverage today, especially on television, mostly calls for short sound bites on what the media establishment determines is the issue of the day. They decide what's important, and you make a brief comment in response. While I can and do play that game, it's not easy for me, and I don't do it particularly well. In a complicated world, I find it hard to respond to the issue of the day in 20 seconds or less. Fourth, and most important, we were at a major disadvantage in that our campaign attempted to offer a serious analysis of the problems facing the country and to provide real solutions to those problems. And that is definitely not where the mainstream media is coming from. For the corporate media, the real issues facing the American people, poverty, the decline of the middle class, income and wealth inequality, trade, healthcare, climate change, etc., are fairly irrelevant. For them, politics is largely presented as entertainment. In fact, there was a popular program on Showtime called The Circus, and that program was not about clowns or acrobats and performing animals. It was about the political campaign. With some notable exceptions, reporters are trained to see a campaign as if it were a game show, a baseball game, a soap opera, or a series of conflicts. Turn on CNN or other networks covering politics, and what you will find is that the overwhelming amount of coverage is dedicated to personality, gossip, campaign strategy, scandals, conflicts, polls, and who appears to be winning or losing, fundraising, the ups and downs of the campaign trail, and the dumb things a candidate may say or do. Political coverage is the drama of what happens on the campaign trail. It has very little to do with the needs of the American people and the ideas or programs a candidate offers to address the problems facing the country. Most of the media coverage is about the candidate. Relatively little is about the enormous crises facing the country. According to a study of media coverage of the 2016 primaries by the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, only 11% of coverage focused on candidates' policy positions, leadership abilities, and professional histories. I find that hard to believe. My personal sense is that number is much too high. The, quote, politics as entertainment approach works very well for someone like Donald Trump, an experienced entertainer. Trump won the Republican primary with a massive amount of media coverage based on his ability to tweet and make sharp personal attacks against his opponents. By late February, Trump had, according to figures cited by The Economist, enjoyed 10 times as much attention on network evening newscasts as Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. For the corporate media, name-calling and personal attacks are easy to cover, and what it prefers to cover. That kind of media approach didn't work so well for a campaign like ours, which was determined to focus on the real problems facing our country and what the solutions might be. Many of the speeches I gave at our rallies were an hour or more, and they dealt with substantive issues. Further, I was at a disadvantage because I have never much been into personal political attacks. In fact, during my entire congressional political career, I have never run one negative ad. I don't claim to be a goody-goody-two-shoes, but it has never made much sense to me to run a campaign in which you spend most of your time telling your constituents how awful, horrible, and terrible your opponent is. Of course you should articulate how your views and proposals are different from your opponent's, but my experience has been that voters much prefer to hear your analysis of the problems they face and how you would address them. Today's media coverage makes that type of campaign very difficult to run. This became a very, very serious problem for us. I learned that reality early on. While I was still considering whether or not to run, I did a long interview with a very prominent national newspaper writer. Over and over I stressed that I wanted to talk about my assessment of the major problems facing the country and how I proposed to address them. And for 45 minutes, that's what the discussion was about. The reporter appeared interested in what I had to say, and I thought we had a good conversation. At the very end, as he was leaving, he said, "Oh, by the way, Hillary Clinton said such and such. What's your comment?" I fell for it. Needless to say, that one-minute response became the major part of his story. And that occurred time after time after time. On a CNN show, an interviewer became visibly angry at me because I chose not to respond to her questions with personal attacks against Secretary Clinton. The interviewer opined that I didn't have sharp enough elbows to become a serious candidate, that I wasn't tough enough. Identifying the major problems facing our country and providing ideas as to how we could address them was just not good enough. In fact, I was gently faulted for having excessive message discipline, for spending too much time discussing real issues. Boring! Not what a successful modern campaign was supposed to be about. The result of all of these factors is that while I was getting coverage, it was far less than what other candidates were getting. In a December 11, 2015 blog post for Media Matters for America, one of the better media watchdogs in the country, Eric Bollert summarized the situation well. And this is what he wrote. ABC World News Tonight has devoted less than 1 minute to Bernie Sanders' campaign this year. Does that ratio seem out of whack? That's the ratio of TV airtime that ABC World News Tonight has devoted to Donald Trump's campaign, 81 minutes, versus the amount of TV time World News Tonight has devoted to Bernie Sanders' campaign this year. And even that 1 minute for Sanders is misleading because the actual number is closer to 20 seconds for the entire year. Bollert continued, the results confirm two media extremes in play this year, and not just at ABC News. The network newscasts are wildly overplaying Trump, who regularly attracts between 20 to 30% of primary voter support, while at the same time wildly underplaying Sanders, who regularly attracts between 20 and 30% of primary voter support. Sanders supporters have long complained about the candidate's lack of coverage. Obviously, Trump is the GOP frontrunner, and it's reasonable that he would get more attention than Sanders, who's running second for the Democrats. But 234 total network minutes for Trump compared to just 10 network minutes for Sanders, as the Tyndall report found? In his article, Bollert also reported that Trump has received more network coverage than all the Democratic candidates combined. Trump has accounted for 27% of all campaign coverage this year. Republican Jeb Bush received 56 minutes of coverage, followed by Ben Carson's 54 minutes and Marco Rubio's 22 minutes. Bollert continued, did you notice the Bush figure? He's garnered 56 minutes of network news coverage, far outpacing Sanders, even though he is currently wallowing in fifth place in the polls among Republicans. And you know who has also received 56 minutes of network news coverage compared to Sanders' 10 minutes? Joe Biden and his decision not to run for president. Bollert concluded, close observers of trends in network news might also say ABC's paltry Sanders coverage isn't surprising, considering the network's flagship news program has recently backed off political coverage, as well as hard news in general. Look at that ABC number again. 261 minutes devoted to campaign coverage this year, and less than 1 minute of that has specifically been for Sanders. How does that even happen? So no, Sanders didn't get virtually ignored this year by World News Tonight because the show's cutting back on campaign coverage. Sanders got virtually ignored by ABC because there was a conscious decision to do so. John Nichols, a very perceptive journalist for The Nation magazine, wrote on March 10, 2016, that the Democratic Party, quote, has a serious race on its hands, as the March 8th upset win for Sanders in Michigan confirmed. Between candidates who are engaged in a great debate about who better represents the progressive ideals of the grassroots activists who have forced open the current discussion about inequality, failed trade policies, mass incarceration, and climate change. Quote, why isn't a contest that features an insurgent candidate mounting a vigorous populist challenge to a former Secretary of State with strong support from party leaders and key constituencies attracting more votes than a Republican contest where the candidates argue about the size of their hands? Anyone who understands how the modern media shape the narrative, as opposed to simply reporting on it, knows the answer. As of late February, the wrangling between Trump and his top two rivals, Rubio and Texas Senator Ted Cruz, was given twice as much coverage on network TV as the Clinton-Sanders contest. That's especially unfair to Sanders, whose challenge to the billionaire class that owns so much of our media has been dismissed and neglected, even as his poll numbers have risen. In my view, one of the reasons that so many people are giving up on the political process is that they do not see the reality of their lives reflected in political discourse or on their television screens. They hurt. They struggle to survive. They worry about their kids. Is anybody paying attention? In the United States today, shamefully, we have 43 million people living in poverty and the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth. Poverty and youth unemployment in minority and rural communities are often off the charts. Homelessness is rampant, and millions of Americans struggle to put food on their table every single day. In Congress and in the media, poverty is an issue that gets very little attention. Here is an example of how absurd that situation is. On May 25, 2016, Media Matters for America discussed the coverage of poverty issues on the major television networks for the first quarter of 2016. This is what was written in a story entitled, "Bernie Sanders Left a Mark on Sunday Show Coverage of Inequality and Poverty." During the survey period, Sunday political talk shows on ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox Broadcasting, and MSNBC featured 27 segments focused on economic inequality and 9 focused specifically on poverty. Interviews with Democratic presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders accounted for 16 of the 27 segments focused on economic inequality and 6 of the 9 segments addressing poverty. Bernie Sanders is the only reason Fox News Sunday talked about inequality. During the survey period, Fox News Sunday registered a single discussion of economic inequality in the United States in an interview with Bernie Sanders, who brought the topic up as part of his core remarks. Sanders highlighted the need for job creation, increasing the federal minimum wage, and single-payer health care. Think about it for a second. What does it say about corporate media coverage of the major issues facing our country when my candidacy alone accounted for the majority of attention, limited though it may have been, that network Sunday news shows paid to poverty, one of the great crises facing the nation? The point here is not my role in raising the issue of poverty and other important issues. The point is how national television coverage doesn't raise it and ignores the reality of important parts of American life. On the campaign trail, I was determined to raise issues that other candidates were not talking about and that have long been ignored. One of those issues, of course, was poverty. As I traveled around the country, I wanted the American people, through the media coverage my campaign was receiving, to get a glimpse of the suffering of their fellow Americans, to get an understanding of what unemployment, low wages, and inadequate housing and health care was doing to the lives of millions. I wanted to let the American people know that these issues were a major priority of mine and to provide specific ideas as to how, if elected president, I would address them. In that regard, I was not successful. Throughout the campaign, in rural areas and urban areas, I went to some of the most distressed parts of the states that I was visiting, places where candidates rarely went. While these visits often got good local coverage, they received, with few exceptions, little national attention. The reality that in the wealthiest country on earth, so many of our people were living in despair and deep poverty was just not something that the national media was particularly interested in. Let me give you some examples. After virtually tying Secretary Clinton in the Iowa caucus and defeating her badly in New Hampshire, I was attracting a lot of national media as I campaigned in South Carolina, the 4th state up in the Democratic nominating process. South Carolina is one of the poorest states in the country, and the governor and the legislature there made a bad situation worse by refusing to expand Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act. In South Carolina, along with some very brave members of the South Carolina legislature, I held a press conference focusing on poverty, high unemployment, low wages, the state's inadequate educational system, and the crisis in health insurance. The press conference was very well attended, with virtually all of the national media there. The legislators, led by Representative Justin Bamberg, had prepared well for the event, were articulate, and gave very forceful comments as to how poverty was impacting the lives of the men, women, and children they represented. Unfortunately, virtually all of the questions we received from the national media were about the campaign. Almost nothing was about poverty. There was virtually no national coverage about the issues we had discussed. It was like living in a parallel universe. The situation at the Native American Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, is a national disgrace, as is the case in many parts of Indian country, to say the very least. In Pine Ridge, unemployment and poverty are rampant, and the educational and healthcare systems are totally inadequate. The youth suicide rate is tragically high, and life expectancy on the reservation is the equivalent of that of a poor third world country. Anyone who has studied American history understands the horrific manner in which the Native American people have been treated from the first day settlers arrived here, long before we even became a country. Throughout our history, the Native American people have been lied to and cheated, have seen their land stolen and the treaties they negotiated abrogated. I was determined to call attention to these issues and to help lead the fight for a new relationship between the Native American people and the U.S. government. The town meeting that I had at the Pine Ridge Reservation brought out hundreds of people. It was an extraordinary afternoon, something that I will never forget. We heard from the tribal leaders, and we heard from a lot of young people who spoke freely about their lives, their dreams, and what they were confronting. I was deeply moved by what I heard. The national media was not. Trahant Reports is a blog written by Mark Trahant, the Charles R. Johnson Professor of Journalism at the University of North Dakota, a member of Idaho's Shoshone Bannock Tribe, a former president of the Native American Journalists Association, and the former editor of the editorial page for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. This is what he wrote on May 14, 2016. Quote, "You have to give Bernie Sanders credit for elevating American Indian and Alaska Native issues. He traveled across Montana, South Dakota, and North Dakota, and at every stop, as he has been doing for months now, he called for a new relationship between the federal government and tribes. The reason we are here today is to try to understand what is going on in Pine Ridge and other reservations," Sanders said. "There are a lot of problems here. Poverty is much too high. There are not enough decent jobs in the area. The healthcare system is inadequate, and we need to fundamentally change the relationship between the U.S. government and the Native American community." Of course, just bringing Native American issues to the surface is a good thing because it forces other candidates to talk about the same issues and come up with possible solutions. Only that's not what's happening. Sanders is getting some press on Native issues, but it's really limited. A quick Google search tells the story. Search Bernie Sanders and Native Americans, and there are some 771,000 hits, including videos of his speeches and a few news clips, mostly from regional newspapers. There has not been a major story from any TV network. The results were similar with press conferences that I held in New York City on the housing crisis there. Speaking with several members of the state legislature and city council at low-income housing projects in the Bronx and Brooklyn, we held media events that talked about the dilapidated conditions that many tenants faced and the $17 billion maintenance backlog that public housing in New York City faced. We talked about the need to rebuild housing in New York and create jobs. Despite a large group of media following us about, there was almost no coverage of this issue. One last example. During the campaign in California, I held a series of media events with experts and leaders in a number of communities on some of the most important issues facing the state. On one occasion, in San Francisco, with several doctors and nurses at my side, we talked about the healthcare crisis and why a Medicare for All single-payer program would be important for California. In a Los Angeles community where fracking had caused health problems, I spoke with local leaders as to why fracking should be banned. At a third meeting in Modesto, I discussed the crisis of climate change and the need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuels. And in Oakland, I held a press conference on income and wealth inequality with Robert Reich, one of the important economists in our country and a former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. These events on issues of enormous consequence generated almost no national coverage by the large press corps following me daily. With one or two exceptions, these matters were just not something of interest to them. On the other hand, from the beginning of the campaign to the end, there were major articles and TV coverage on all kinds of stuff that no normal human being was particularly interested in. When was I going to announce my intention to run? When was I going to announce my intention to drop out? When was I going to endorse Clinton? Why wasn't I spending more time shaking hands and kissing babies? Why did certain staff members leave the campaign? Why were the campaign staffing levels reduced? What did I have for breakfast? I remember cringing when the car I was traveling in was pulled over in Iowa because we were speeding to an event with a New York Times reporter in the back seat. The state trooper was professional and polite and gave us a warning. Not so the reporter, who, it goes without saying, made it a major part of her coverage. This is not to say that our campaign did not receive a lot of very positive coverage. We did. And it is not to say that the media was especially negative toward me or disliked me. That was not the case. It is to say that, generally speaking, the less relevant the issue was to the lives of the American people, the more attention it got. We had great local and national print and TV coverage about the huge crowds we were drawing at our rallies, about the unprecedented nature of our small donation fundraising, about the enthusiasm of our supporters, about our volunteer network, about the outstanding work our social media team was doing, and about the high quality of our television ads. There were also some excellent magazine articles and blog reports that really did understand what our campaign was trying to accomplish. In terms of good exposure, the best coverage we received was when I was able to communicate with people directly without the filter of the media. And we were able to do that quite frequently. I was pleasantly surprised that cable TV networks would broadcast parts or occasionally all of the speeches that I gave at our rallies. This would often occur after we had won a caucus or primary. Further, for me, one of the most effective and enjoyable means of communication was through live TV forums or town meetings. There were a number of them sponsored by CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. They took place in states where primaries or caucuses were occurring. The format was pretty simple. I would respond to questions from a moderator, and then he or she would open the floor for questions from a live audience. This format gave me the opportunity to provide answers that went beyond a 30-second soundbite. I also found that almost all of the questions from the audience were about real and relevant issues, not about political gossip or the process. The hosts for these events, who generally did a very good job, were Chris Cuomo, Anderson Cooper, Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, Brett Baer, and Chris Matthews. Why is it that the mainstream media sees politics as entertainment and largely ignores the major crises facing our country? The answer lies in the fact, which is very rarely discussed and almost never in the mainstream media, that corporate media is owned by, well, large multinational corporations. And in case you haven't heard, these corporations have an agenda that serves their bottom line. In fact, that's the reason for their existence. In other words, it is time for the American people to understand that corporate media in America is not some kind of objective entity that sees its function as providing, as best it can, truth to its viewers, listeners, and readers. Quite the contrary. Corporate media is made up of businesses, very large businesses, whose primary function is to make as much money as they possibly can. And in every instance, the largest media corporations are themselves owned by even larger conglomerates that have their own particular set of economic interests. Let me give you a few examples. General Electric was, until several years ago, one of the major media conglomerates in the country, until they sold their media interests to Comcast. Before that, they were the owners of the NBC television network and a massive amount of other media. As one of the largest corporations in America, General Electric has extensive interest in areas other than media. It is a major manufacturer employing a very large number of people. Over the years, GE helped lead the way in taking advantage of trade deals that allowed them to shut down numerous factories in the United States and outsource tens of thousands of American jobs to low-wage countries. In fact, the CEO of GE touted the company's goal of moving facilities to China. General Electric is also very aggressive in trying to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Despite making billions in profits, they use hundreds of accountants and lawyers to exploit tax laws that their lobbyists help write so that in some years they don't pay anything, not a nickel, in federal taxes. General Electric is a major polluter. According to the Boston Globe, and I quote, "The General Electric Company is sharply objecting to a new federal plan that would force it to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to remove massive amounts of toxic chemicals from the Housatonic River, which the company polluted for nearly 50 years, end quote. Given the economic realities of the General Electric Corporation, what kind of approach do you think NBC had to such issues as outsourcing, taxation, labor relations, and environmental protection? The answer is that for NBC and other networks with similar types of conflicts, these major issues facing our country were largely ignored. Over the years, for example, trade policy received almost no coverage at all from the major networks. Remember, what is important about media coverage is not just how they cover an issue, it is whether they cover it at all. Disney, the owner of ABC, has many thousands of employees in China manufacturing their products at very low wages. In the United States, they have utilized guest worker programs to fire Americans and replace them with low-wage foreign workers. Further, despite making huge profits, they pay the people who work at their theme parks very low wages. I could be wrong, but I don't expect that you will see programming tonight on ABC discussing the plight of low-wage workers here in the United States, or for that matter, in China. There will also not be much mention of how corporate America is exploiting guest worker programs. Rupert Murdoch, a right-wing billionaire, is one of the most powerful people on the planet. His news corporation owns enormous amounts of media throughout the world, including the major newspapers on three continents, North America, Europe, and Australia. In the United States, Murdoch's major holdings include Fox Television, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Post, TV Guide, and Barron's. At a time when scientists speak in increasingly urgent tones about the planetary crisis of climate change, Murdoch works in tandem with the fossil fuel industry in rejecting science. Farron Cousins of the blog DeSmog Blog writes, quote, "When it comes to climate change misinformation, arguably no single person has done more to spread false information or confuse the public than Rupert Murdoch. With his vast media empire that spans the globe, Murdoch has helped misdirect the public as well as to openly advocate against government policies that would curtail carbon emissions or impose other environmental safeguards," end of quote. The scientists tell us in an almost unanimous voice that we must transform our energy system away from fossil fuels. Rupert Murdoch disagrees, and hundreds of millions of people are influenced by his ignorance and special interests. It is not just, however, the inherent conflict of interest between the billionaires who own the media and the, quote, news their companies convey. There is also the extraordinary power of the multinational corporations that provide billions of dollars a year in advertising revenue to the corporate owners of the media. If you watch TV tonight, check out how many ads come from drug companies, insurance companies, the fossil fuel industry, Wall Street, automobile companies, and the rest of corporate America. These powerful corporations also have an agenda, and it would be naive not to believe that their views and needs impact coverage of issues important to them. Seen any specials lately as to why we pay the highest prices in the world for our prescription drugs? or why we are the only major country on earth not to have a national healthcare program? That may have something to do with the hundreds of millions of dollars each year that drug companies and insurance companies spend on advertising. And let us also not forget that the leading personalities we see on television are themselves, in most cases, multi-millionaires with very generous contracts. That does not make them evil or bad people. It just makes them very wealthy corporate employees who bring to their jobs the perspective that very wealthy corporate employees bring. No, I don't believe that there is some kind of conspiracy in which corporate bosses get on the phone and tell a journalist what to write or say on television. No, in terms of politics, I don't think that most journalists are right-wingers who have it in for progressives or Democrats. But what I believe very strongly, what the evidence clearly indicates, and what I observed in my campaign, is that there is a defined and clear approach in corporate media that determines what is, quote, important and worthy of coverage, and what is not. My experience is that very few journalists cross those boundaries. Over the course of my political life, I cannot recall a mainstream journalist coming up to me and asking what I was going to do to end the scourge of poverty in this country, or how I was going to combat the disgraceful level of income and wealth inequality, or what role I would play in ending the influence of big money in politics. Those and many similar issues are just not what corporate America considers to be important. And my strong guess is that if by mistake, or in some state of confusion, a reporter for the corporate media started asking those types of questions, he or she would not last long with the company. As I traveled throughout the country, I found that local media was often more interested in real issues than was the national media. The local reporters were not as cynical as their national counterparts, and in many instances had a real understanding and concern about the issues facing their communities. I was especially impressed by the serious coverage provided by reporters in states like Iowa and New Hampshire. Let me also give a shout out to some real heroes and heroines. These are people who, with resources far more limited than their corporate competitors, try to inform the American people about the real issues facing our country, issues often ignored or minimized by the corporate media. We received very fair coverage in our campaign from Tom Hartman, Cenk Uygur of the Young Turks, and Amy Goodman of Democracy Now!, the folks at The Nation in these times, The Progressive, and a number of other smaller publications and blogs also worked extremely hard to allow us to convey our message to the American people. Ed Schultz, the Reverend Al Sharpton, Rachel Maddow, and Chris Hayes provided us with a very fair coverage we received on MSNBC. I was also pleased to have been on the Bill Moyers program on PBS on several occasions. The issue of corporate control over the media and the degree to which a few large entities can determine what the American people see, hear, and read has concerned me for many years. In fact, it's hard for me to understand how anyone who cares about the future of this country cannot be concerned. As a member of the U.S. House, I held several town meetings on this issue in Vermont that had very large turnouts. In a meeting in St. Michael's College in 2003, Michael Copps, who was then a commissioner at the FCC, gave a brilliant discourse on what corporate control means in terms of limiting the points of view that the American people are able to hear. How can we have a vibrant democracy when only one side of an issue gets discussed? Is it an accident that in a nation politically divided, almost all of talk radio is extremely right-wing? He also discussed the impact of media concentration on minority communities and the relatively small amount of media owned by blacks, Latinos, and other minorities. Further, he raised the very important point of what it means when a small community has no locally owned media. Who's going to cover the city council or the school board? How can people become informed about local issues? Commissioner Copps also talked about the impact of corporate and national ownership of media on culture, and how difficult it was for local musicians to get heard when so much of the music piped into the community came from big-name, nationally known artists. I also had town meetings in Vermont with John Nichols and Bob McChesney, who have written extensively about this subject. In my own political life, the issue of big money ownership of media was, I must confess, also personal. When I was mayor of Burlington, I had to withstand horrendous editorials from the local newspaper, the largest paper in the state, day after day after day. Their dislike of me and progressive politics was also reflected in their reporting. It was also a little bit weird that in those days, the owner of the largest TV station in the state was an open financial supporter of the state's Republican Party. And make no mistake about it, that bias was reflected in their reporting. In my campaign for president, I received 46% of the pledged delegates, won 22 states, and lost some states by just a few votes. In other words, we had a significant amount of support from ordinary people. On the other hand, I did not win 46% of the endorsements from the print establishment and the leading newspapers in the country. In fact, I won virtually none. In almost every state, the owners of the establishment newspapers supported Secretary Clinton. I was very proud to have received the endorsement of the Seattle Times. Among all the major newspapers throughout this country, that was it. We received one major newspaper endorsement. On the other hand, Clinton won the endorsements of the Des Moines Register, the Concord Monitor, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the Dallas Morning News, the Tampa Bay Times, the Houston Chronicle, the Las Vegas Sun, the Star Tribune of Minneapolis, the Detroit Free Press, the Miami Herald, the Omaha World Herald, the Charlotte Observer, the Chicago Sun-Times, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Cincinnati Enquirer, the Plain Dealer of Cleveland, the Arizona Republic, the Idaho Statesman, New York's Daily News, the Providence Journal, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Hartford Courant, the Baltimore Sun, the Los Angeles Times, the Santa Fe New Mexican, and a number of other publications. Who owns the media? Most Americans have very little understanding of the degree to which media ownership in America, what we see, hear, and read, is concentrated in the hands of a few giant corporations. In fact, I suspect that when people look at the hundreds of channels they receive on their cable system or the many hundreds of magazines they can choose from in a good bookstore, they assume that there is a wide diversity of ownership. Unfortunately, that is not the case. In 1983, the largest 50 corporations controlled 90% of the media. That's a high level of concentration. Today, as a result of massive mergers and takeovers, six corporations control 90% of what we see, hear, and read. This is outrageous and a real threat to our democracy. Those six corporations are Comcast, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. In 2010, the total revenue of these six corporations was $275 billion. In a recent article in Forbes magazine discussing media ownership, the headline appropriately read, quote, "These 15 billionaires own America's news media companies," end quote. Exploding technology is transforming the media world, and mergers and takeovers are changing the nature of ownership. FreePress.net is one of the best media watchdog organizations in the country and has been opposed to the kind of media consolidation that we have seen in recent years. It has put together a very powerful description of what media concentration means. Some examples from Free Press are included in a PDF that comes with this program. No sane person denies that the media plays an enormously important role in shaping public consciousness and determining political outcomes. The current media situation in America, where a handful of giant corporations controls the flow of information, is a very serious threat to our democracy. The very First Amendment to our Constitution guarantees freedom of speech and freedom of the press, the right of the people to express their points of view from the rooftops, to allow themselves to be heard. This is something I passionately believe in, because it is the essence of our democracy. Unfortunately, as A.J. Liebling wrote back in 1960, and I quote, "Freedom of the press is guaranteed only to those who own one," end quote. And the people who own the press, radio and television stations, and book publishing and movie companies are becoming fewer and fewer with more and more power. This is a crisis that can no longer be ignored. Conclusion. There were tears and there was disappointment at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia when I addressed the delegates there on July 26th. For the almost 2,000 Sanders supporters who were there that night and the millions who watched on television, there was the understanding that we had defied the odds, that we had almost pulled off one of the great upsets in American political history, that we had come so very far, just not far enough. What I said that night, and what I repeat now, is that election days come and go, and our campaign is over. But the political revolution, our revolution, must continue. The fight for economic, social, racial, and environmental justice can never stop. The fight to defeat the greed of the billionaire class must continue. I hope very much that my campaign for president will not be endlessly discussed from an historical perspective, looking back. I hope that my efforts and the incredibly hard work of hundreds of thousands of grassroots volunteers in every state in our country will be seen as a turning point in American politics and a blueprint for the future. For the people who worked in our campaign, I hope that you will stay involved and get your friends involved. Run for the school board. Run for city council. Run for state legislature. Run for governor. Run for Congress. Run for the U.S. Senate. Run for president. Hold your elected officials accountable. Know what they are doing and how they are voting. And tell your neighbors. But transforming America is more than just elections. It's about changing our culture. Demand that the media focuses on the real issues facing our nation and the world, not just political gossip. And if corporate media won't change, and they won't, start new media. The internet offers revolutionary prospects. This nation treats our children shamefully. We must focus on the needs of the young, especially the many who are disadvantaged. As we change our national priorities, we must prioritize education, and we will be in desperate need of great educators and child care workers. With so many Americans uninsured and underinsured, we need hundreds of thousands of new doctors, dentists, nurses, and other medical personnel. We should not be lagging behind many other countries in life expectancy, especially for lower-income Americans. We need a radical change in our criminal justice system. We need new law enforcement officials and police officers who understand that our primary goal must be crime prevention, which requires a whole new level of cooperation with educators, social workers, and employers. In order to combat the global threat of climate change, we need scientists and engineers who will develop clean and inexpensive forms of energy and transportation. There is unbelievable potential in the energy field, and we must not allow the fossil fuel industry to stop us. We need business people who create and sell new and innovative products and services and who treat their employees with respect and dignity while protecting the environment. Our goal must be to use the exploding technology that we are experiencing to improve life for our people, not to increase unemployment or invade our privacy. As I've said before, I ended the campaign with far more optimism about the future of this country than when I began. I had the incredible privilege of seeing the future in the eyes of well over a million Americans who came out to our town meetings and rallies, many of them young people. They were white, black, Latino, Native Americans, and Asian American. They were men and women, gay and straight. Most were born in this country. Some immigrated here. But they all understood that when we stand together, when we don't allow demagogues to divide us up, there is nothing we cannot accomplish. They love this country, and they know that we can do much, much better. The great crisis that we face as a nation is not just the objective problems that we face, a rigged economy, a corrupt campaign finance system, a broken criminal justice system, and the extraordinary threat of climate change. The more serious crisis is the limitation of our imaginations. It is falling victim to an incredibly powerful establishment, economic, political, and media, that tells us every day in a million different ways that real change is unthinkable and impossible, that we have got to think small, not big, that we must be satisfied with the status quo, that there are no alternatives. The future of our country and perhaps the world requires us to break through those limitations. Humanity is at a crossroads. We can continue down the current path of greed, consumerism, oligarchy, poverty, war, racism, and environmental degradation, or we can lead the world in moving in a very different direction. Yes, we can overcome the insatiable greed that now exists and create an economy that ends poverty and provides a decent standard of living for all. Yes, we can create a vibrant democracy where knowledgeable citizens actively debate the great challenges they face. Yes, we can create a healthcare system that guarantees healthcare for every man, woman, and child, and that focuses on disease prevention and keeping us healthy, not outrageous profits for insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industry. Yes, we can effectively combat climate change and transform our energy system away from fossil fuel and into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. No, we will not be able to accomplish those goals if we look at democracy as a spectator sport, assuming others will do it for us. They won't. The future is in your hands. Let's get to work.
This is Mark Ruffalo. We hope you enjoyed this production of Our Revolution by Bernie Sanders.